Hello, I'm Dr. Albert Rizzo, Chief Medical Officer of the American Lung Association. Welcome to Lungcast. ...2022 marks the 30th anniversary of the founding of the American Association of Bronchology and Interventional Pulmonology. This organization was among the first, surprisingly, to provide a network and resources for providers responsible with managing screening and care for leading causes of pulmonary death, including lung cancer and COPD. Contrast the recency of the American Association of Bronchology and Interventional Pulmonology being founded against that of the American Lung Association, which celebrates its 118th anniversary this year. This is about as young as key medical subspecialty organizations come. Today's interview features Dr. Carla Lamb. She is Director of Interventional Pulmonary Medicine and Interventional Pulmonary Fellowship Program at the Lehigh Hospital and Medical Center. As a pioneer in the field of interventional pulmonology, she is a diplomat of the American Association of Bronchology and Interventional Pulmonology. Dr. Lamb joins us to discuss her role in developing early interventional pulmonary training and recommendations, the utility of key diagnostic tools in the subspecialty, and evolving roles for lung cancer treatments, including bronchial stents, modernized COPD intervention and research, and the future of interventional pulmonary medicine. It's a leading perspective on the young history of a growing field on this episode of Lungcast. We hope you enjoy. So, Dr. Lamb, you have been very involved with the development of the relatively young subspecialty field of interventional pulmonology. The American Association of Bronchology and Interventional Pulmonology was founded back in 1992. Board certification, I believe, first became available recently in 2017. You've been involved in the development of fellowship guidelines for pulmonary training programs and have been part of expert panels outlining the use of techniques such as endobronchial ultrasounds. I know in my career, the increasing role of endobronchial ultrasound, I saw as a defining moment for those of us who were to remain general bronchoscopists or decide to augment our training to develop the skills to become an interventional pulmonologist. I decided not to. You are well recognized as a scholarly researcher, educator, and innovator in this field. And before we begin speaking of the specific diagnostic and therapeutic roles of an interventional pulmonologist and the tools they use, can you tell me how you got attracted to this field?
Sure. Thank you for that, this opportunity, Dr. Rizzo, to kind of speak about this. You know, I think that, you know, if we look at historically, you know, interventional pulmonology became out of necessity. It kind of was founded out of necessity. There was other needs that patients had that could be satisfied procedurally, and technology and the efforts to marry the technology to the right patient scenario and to really apply it to a particular disease process in an innovative way has really continued to drive the field further. And really, in addition to that, the way we train to become an interventional pulmonologist has really evolved as well. Just by way of history, I mean, the evolution, there's some historic things that have happened even this week that I'll be able to share with you also, is that, you know, the first IP board exam actually was in 2014. And it took really decades and decades of time worldwide and certainly in the U.S. to really garner physicians who were going into this newly evolving field, still being defined and continuing to evolve and being defined. And as of 2022, there are now 42 multi-societal accredited interventional pulmonary fellowship programs that are in generally a year, 1 to 2 year fellowship programs, the majority being 1 year programs, which is really tremendous. And after a lot of work and dedication, trying to really contribute to the field in the academic peer-reviewed literature, try to drive things based by evidence, we found out this week that we, after pretty labor-intensive process, the ACGME has now accepted our application to be recognized as a distinct subspecialty within the field of pulmonary medicine, truly defined by interventional pulmonary. Now, we stand on the shoulders of many. So I would say I'm a small piece of the puzzle, but very proud to be part of the puzzle. And I think to go back to the question you asked, why did I find myself interested? Well, I had mentors that I saw them in practice applying new technologies, becoming early adopters to new technology, but with a practical application that really made a difference and an impact for patients. So I think I've really been driven in my career to be patient-facing and very motivated by what can we offer a patient that may make them breathe better, cure something potentially, solve a problem that doesn't have a solution medically. If a procedure can be aligned with that in a meaningful way, it's a very fulfilling practice in order to be able to shepherd a patient through their disease process from early detection to diagnosis, treatment. And even in the most advanced of diseases, we now have minimally invasive procedural offerings that may make a difference for a patient's quality of life. Even when you may not be able to cure something, you may be able to impact quality of life, which it, to me is a tremendous privilege to be a participant in. So that's probably my, even to this day, continues to motivate me to push in the field, try to train other young physicians responsibly, give physicians who are even in mid-career who change their career path or want to adopt a new technology, find responsible ways of training in the technology.
Very well stated, and it's great that the field now is recognized as a subspecialty. I'm sure that took a lot of work, as you stated. A question about the fellowships. Is that one-year fellowship in addition to the traditional pulmonary fellowship, or is that incorporated into the two-year program?
It actually is added to the traditional three-year Palm Creek Care Fellowship. So it's an additional year beyond that. And it really, when you think about it, that year is very compact, but it really is layered into in addition to the general Palm Creek Care Fellowship.
So, and now the interventional pulmonologist has now become very important to the establishment and implementation of low-dose lung cancer screening programs, which is really a key imperative of the Lung Association to improve the number of people being screened. And I know your work at the Leahy Clinic has been pioneering in this area. Can you please tell us about the establishment of the Rescue Lung, Rescue Life Society you were so instrumental in?
Absolutely. You know, I have to say, Leahy, I'm very proud to be part of the Leahy organization, and that we've been a group of innovators and first. You know, we were the first interventional pulmonary fellowship program that was really established in a comprehensive way in 1996 in the country. And then with lung screening, Leahy, outside of the NLST, was one of the earliest adopters to lung screening CT with low-dose CT over a decade ago. We've reached our decade mark in lung screening here at Leahy, and it was really an effort of Dr. Brady McKee, Dr. Andrea McKee. They were really the leaders of our group, but we formed a steering committee, and in conjunction with Leahy as an institution, we were able to lift up early adoption of lung screening, get the word out with our primary care team and to our patients, and provide it even before it was really recognized and covered by third-party payers, because it was such a profound groundbreaking in terms of saving lives by early detection. It was very compelling in the New England Journal article that was published in 2011. And from that, we've really borne out the Rescue Lung, Rescue Life Society is really kind of garnered with the sole mission to saving lives through early lung cancer detection through low-dose CT or CT lung screening, rather. And we've been able to see it evolve, and we've been able to educate and share our materials and our lessons learned with more than, a countless number of programs throughout the country who have adopted our process and have applied that and started their own lung screening programs across the world, actually. So we have an international outreach in that regard, and with a very, very singular focus to saving lives through lung screening in a responsible way, based on evidence-based guidelines, and also making the public aware and patients aware, and tracking our quality metrics keeping a registry so that we can track patients from inception to their enrollment and to their long-term follow-up throughout the continuation of their participation in the program.
The reputation of Leahy is unquestionable in this regard, so thank you for that. One of the reasons cited for some of the slow uptake of CT screening nationally, which I think stands around 6% over the last 10 years since the NSLT, even though it showed 20% mortality benefit, there's been concern over false positives and the subsequent potential complications of unwarranted procedures. Now, what are some of the evolving IP techniques and devices that are available to help make the approach to low-dose CT screening for lung cancer less likely to lead to unwarranted surgeries or complications for potentially benign disease?
Mm-hmm. So I would start off with a couple of things. You know, we know that since March of 2021, there's been an adoption to broadening the inclusion criteria for lung screening. So before, there were about 9 million patients eligible for screening. Now we've nearly doubled that to nearly 18 million eligible patient screening. We have a lot of work to do for screening. Massachusetts is actually one of the leading states for screening, but we have a lot of work yet to do also. What I would remind the listeners about inclusion, right now the new criteria is age 50 to 80 years of age, at least a 20-pack year tobacco history. And there's some evolution about the timing of quit, 15 years of quitting. We believe that going forward in the future, we will see a dropping off of that need, and where patients will be eligible for longer screening beyond the 15-year quit rate, because we know that patients continue to age into lung cancer far beyond their smoking cessation days. And so that's a work in progress, but for now, the criteria has opened up the door for more people to be screened. Now, getting back to this, the quoting of the false positive rate, I would say, unfortunately, even in the published literature, it's misquoted. And so hopefully this will give me an opportunity to clarify that. You know, when we think about the original NLST, you have to remember the size of the nodule that they deemed positive was a smaller nodule size at 4 millimeters. Over evolution of lung RADS, the standardized, one of the standardized reporting, validated reporting systems, that evolved, and this was supported and endorsed by the American College of Radiology, is that the nodule size is now really 6 millimeter and beyond. So with the change in the size of what defines a positive, the false positive rate invariably went down just based on that definition alone, number one. So, and then if a patient begins with their first lung screening scan, but they remain in the program on one and two consecutive screening scans, the false positive rate potential in that patient markedly declines from what was previously quoted as high as 26% now to really 7% and sometimes even lower. So I would want to make that point and stress that point that the false positive rate is far, far lower now with the evolution of what's defined as a positive in the first place. And number two, patients who maintain continuation in a lung screening program beyond their first scan, it markedly drops that false positive for each respective patient, less than 7%. So I think that's a very important point. But I do think it also still requires us to be very responsible in how we discuss with the patient the finding. And the majority of patients who have a lung screening scan will have a normal scan or a non-actionable a scan, meaning no abnormal finding requiring an intervention. But I think this is where by having a multidisciplinary group of experts who are looking and guiding, in addition to the lung RADS recommendation, to responsibly manage those patients who clearly do need further activation of a pathway of diagnostic evaluation, to those who can safely and responsibly be followed with just serial CT scans based on the guidelines and the recommendation of lung RADS. Now, regarding, you know, in the interventional field, how do we come into play? Well, I think for those patients who do have a nodule that is more suspect based on lung RADS and being in the high-risk category, I think we look at those patients and say, how can we minimally invasively define what that nodule is beyond the scan? And so the evolution of interventional really incorporates several things. Now there are autoantibody measurements that can be done in the serum and the blood. There are now, through registries and evolving, our nasal brushings to look at messenger RNA epithelial injury patterns to further risk stratify a nodule beyond a CT scan and even beyond a PET or in conjunction with those. There are endobronchial brushings that can also pick up, again, an mRNA epithelial injury pattern that may translate from the nasal mucosa to the bronchial mucosa to that distal, more peripheral nodule. So those are some things that can be integrated as part of the workup. But more specific to interventional, now the evolution has gone from basic bronchoscopy to EBUS, radial probe EBUS to reach out in the periphery to identify that you are at your target before you take your biopsy, to electromagnetic navigation tools and catheters. And now most recently, over the last several years, at least two approved platforms of robotic bronchoscopy. And what they do is they extend the reach on those small nodules that are deemed to be worthy of a biopsy. The beauty of a robotic bronchoscopy and a bronchoscopic inspection or assessment to those nodules is that we can look at the mediastinum with linear EBUS and assess that. We go to the peripheral nodule with the robotic tool. It's a slimmer, a much smaller catheter. It has dexterity beyond anything that's out there. It's kind of the newest iteration of making us the most dexterous in the most peripheral spaces to get the smallest nodules that were deemed in the past not attainable by bronchoscopy. So that's probably the most groundbreaking evolution that we're currently putting into practice at the bedside currently. And the goal and the hope is that we can evolve into, and trials are currently actively being done, delivery of therapeutic medications or thermal therapies to ablate cancerous nodules that are singular nodules that can be treated in a minimally invasive and even a non-surgical way. So that's in the future, but rapidly being evaluated and tested.
You kind of touched on what I was going to ask next with regard to some therapeutic modalities for lung cancer. I know bronchial stents, bronchial brachytherapy, are those still useful procedures and techniques at this point in time?
Right. Well, I'll speak a little bit about stents. So stents in the airway, whether it be the trachea, the bronchi, or the lobar orifices, there's different indications for stenting. Some are benign and some are for malignant diseases. So let me touch a little bit on benign diseases. For benign diseases, patients who have tracheal stenosis, narrowing of the trachea, in addition to dilating the airway and before evaluation for a surgical reconstruction in patients who may not be surgical candidates or at least initially need an intervention because of the degree of narrowing for more immediate effect, we can use that stenting that can be temporary and removable to really help give patients or restore a patient's airway in a very efficient way, in a safe way. There's other diseases called extrinsic dynamic airway collapse and then also tracheal malacia on a spectrum where patients may have tremendous cough, recurrent infections, and daily symptoms with a disease that's somewhat rare and often unrecognized. But once recognized, a stent trial can be the first step to determine if that pathophysiology, when remedied with stenting, renders resolution of the symptoms the patient was presenting with. And that can be a bridge to a surgical intervention such as a tracheal or tracheal bronchial plication to more permanently remedy that physiology. Now, regarding malignancy, typically we think about stenting primarily for patients who have more advanced disease or happen to have more central airway disease that's advanced, that cannot be surgically resected, as a bridge to improve symptoms immediately, as a bridge for them to get their systemic therapy, such as chemotherapy, radiation, or a combination of the two. So I think that the role of stenting is certainly still a cornerstone for what interventional pulmonologists bring to the field that's unique. It's been longstanding for decades. They've stood the test of time. Some of the newest iterations are now there are the ability to create stents that are truly custom like 3D replicas, if you will, of the patient's own unique airway and nuances. And that's, I think, phenomenal, because then a stent that fits truly custom ordered to the patient for that reason. So yes, stents, I think, do still have a role. We hope that with early detection and lung screening, the need for treatment of advanced disease will go down, but that's still not the case. It's something that we aspire to. And then you mentioned about endobronchial brachytherapy, and there is still a role for it. A couple of things to think about. Now, currently, we can apply many different types of thermal therapies to the airway for very focused diseases. That can range from YAP laser, endoluminal ablation. It could be argon plasma coagulation, electrocautery. It could be photodynamic therapy that's applied bronchoscopically. It could also be, again, for more focal or segmented disease that does not meet criteria for surgery, or the patient chooses not to proceed with a surgical option when something's focal and endoluminal. And then there are benign diseases that can be treated endoluminal with different ablative therapies like that. Excuse me. And then cryotherapy on the other side of things, on the other end of the spectrum of the thermal spectrum. Now, when it comes to endobronchial brachytherapy, typically we think of it in two constructs. One is a patient who has very focal disease where you can actually really parse out exactly where you're going to treat and apply bronchoscopically a brachytherapy catheter, and then allow that to be applied by our radiation oncology and our physicist to apply a very focused, intense radiotherapy into the lumen of the airway for localized disease, but also for more advanced disease where the patient has really expended the use of other systemic therapies, traditional external beam radiation, when there's a focal area that's causing obstruction that may be cannulated or reopened with a focal area of treatment, and also to ablate symptoms of coughing up blood, hemoptysis, airway narrowing or obstruction, things of that nature.
So I wanted to switch gears a little bit and talk about some of the obstructive lung diseases, particularly start out talking about the asthmatic patient who may or may not benefit from bronchial thermoplasty because they don't seem to respond or require or fit into the biologic therapies at this point in time. What's been your experience with bronchial thermoplasty?
So bronchial thermoplasty, I think, you know, what we're seeing in the field of interventional pulmonary as devices are being tested in peer-reviewed, evidence-based ways, we're seeing device testing to be under, you know, significant and appropriate scrutiny in order to see before it makes its way to market for safety and then efficacy and then sustainability of results and practicality of use, as well as cost effectiveness. So when we think about bronchial thermoplasty, it's evolved over the last decade. It's, you know, been available on the market for several years, of course, after going through all the FDA clearance process. You know, and then we had this big burgeoning group of biologics that have really exploded on the market in the last few years. So I think of bronchial thermoplasty in several ways. You know, in the published literature, it is something that can provide relief in certain select patients. I think the important thing is when you have a patient who has severe persistent asthma, despite usual conventional therapy, medical therapy, we're learning more and more about phenotyping and identifying unique subsets of asthma patients so that all asthma is not equal when it gets into the severe category. So the basic things are making sure the patient's compliant, that we've identified that the patients don't have any other competing illnesses that are contributing to refractoriness to treatment of asthma, such as unchecked gastroesophageal reflux, unchecked sinus disease, unchecked allergies, again, inadvertent or non-compliance with medications, and then looking at their peripheral eosinophil counts to see if they may meet a phenotype that would be better served with biologics. So I think when I think about bronchial thermoplasty, it's a heat ablative therapy to reduce the smooth muscle, to create atrophy of smooth muscles in the distal small airways that are responsible for the majority of the bronchoconstriction, that it could be part of a phenotype of some patients' asthma. And it also can reduce the mucus glands within the airway and also reduce that perpetuation of inflammatory cells that seem to rest quietly even on a good day for a patient who may have their asthma in better control than on another day. So when you think about bronchial thermoplasty, I think of it on a spectrum. It's not for every patient, but in patients who are not candidates for biologics, or patients who have expended all options, including biologics, and still have refractoriness, despite all the due diligence of looking for other diseases, then these patients may benefit from bronchial thermoplasty in that context. And it's three sequential treatments, 3 weeks apart, first to the right lower, then to the left lower lobe, and airways rather, and then the upper lobes. And I have seen, you know, and certainly it's been shown in the literature that there's a sustained benefit in those patients who do deem benefit, meaning when I say benefit, reduction of severity of exacerbations, reduction of need for prednisone bursts and tapers because of exacerbation, reduction of hospitalization, and reduction of missed days of work or school, whichever the case may be, because of their asthma. So I think that it's something that I still offer patients. It's one of those things that it's, again, not for everyone. I think there's a lot of upfront work that has to be done by provider and patient before that decision is made, but it's certainly an option to consider.
Well, the other big obstructive disease is COPD, and I know interventional pulmonology is making some advances to really help the patient's symptoms and quality of life. I'm particularly referring to the volume reduction techniques at the endobronchial valves. I know you've been instrumental in introducing the Zephyr valve program at Lahey, and also the use of rheoplasty in targeted lung denervation. I believe you were part of the Airflow 3 clinical trial. Can you explain what makes a COPD patient a potential candidate for some of these modalities and the assessment that is needed prior to that determination?
Sure. So when we think about bronchoscopic lung volume reduction, again, there are different valves on the market, and different patients may have different anatomic needs. So both serve the equal purpose, the same purpose for bronchoscopic lung volume reduction. So who should be considered for this? Well, patients who are no longer actively using tobacco, patients who are optimized with medical therapies. There must be a level of severity of COPD defined by pulmonary function studies. And the patient also must be ambulatory enough to be able to benefit from the procedure. And I'll talk about what the benefits may be in select patients. The most crucial part, I would say, is the patients have to have a physiology in which they are hyperinflated and demonstrate air trapping, and that's purely defined by lung volume testing physiologically to reach a certain threshold number. For example, total lung capacity of 100% or greater, and in general, a residual volume of greater than 175% for certain valves, others at least 150%. But I think that, you know, patients need to have completed or actively enrolled in a pulmonary rehab exercise program. I probably can't stress that enough. And many of the studies, the patients who underwent successfully and could accomplish a pulmonary rehab exercise program and then maintain that on the other side of their getting the procedure, had better outcomes and sustained benefit. So what are the benefits for bronchoscopic lung volume reduction? And how does it work? Well, there's no incisions involved. It's not a surgery. It's actually applied through the bronchoscope, and we use a mapping for that individual patient, identifying which lobe of lung has the most emphysema or COPD, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, or emphysema. If we can target a singular lobe, we actually will introduce valves into the airways leading to that lobe by completely occluding them with these valves, averaging 3 to 6 valves per lobe in a given patient. That causes decrease in airflow or prevention of airflow, causing that lobe of lung to shrink, if you will. And it allows the diaphragms that have historically been pushed down very flat because of the overinflation of the lobes, it allows the diaphragm to dome as a muscle and have a true swinging back and forth. It restores the function of the diaphragm. It also allows the more normal, less diseased lung to occupy that real estate to allow for improved deficiency in physiology, and that translates to less shortness of breath with activity. The other thing is reduction of the severity of exacerbations, the number of flare-ups of COPD, the reduction of hospitalizations or ER visits. And some of the most poignant examples I have in my own patients are patients who were avid golfers before their disease got ahead of them. And I have a gentleman, even to this day, he's 3 years out from his valve placement, doing very well. He was able to resume his golfing hobby, which was tremendous, because he wasn't even sure that would be something he could achieve. And that really, I think people can relate to being able to golf or go dancing. One of my patients texted me on New Year's Eve dancing the night away when she had not been able to dance because she was so breathless before her procedure. So those are some real extreme examples, but I think it's the bottom line is people get their lives back on some scale. If improperly selected patients, unfortunately, the procedure's not for everyone, so there's definitely a very rigorous selection process, but for good reason.
Do those valves stay in place, or are there times when they're taken out?
So that's a great question. This is something that we're now learning. So there's this phase where everyone was being evaluated for initial placement, and now the question is, well, how long does the effect last? I think we're still learning that. And is there room for a revision? And the answer is yes. And so again, some of this is still evolving. So I, take it for that information. But typically we follow patients after their initial procedure. We see them within 1 month, 3 months, 6 months, 12 months. That first year is pretty intense for follow-up. Patients will often feel a benefit either sometimes right away or within the first month. If over time their effect seems to wane or reduce, we actually image the patient with a CT scan, and we often will do bronchoscopy to confirm that the valves have not developed granulation tissue, that they haven't migrated or shifted in such a way that they're no longer serving that seal point for causing the atelectasis or reduction of the volume of that lobe. And there is room for revision if that's been observed. And then I think what we're evolving to now is patients who have one lobe treated. Over time, we may identify a second lobe to be treated. So I think we're evolving into, right now, singular lobe treatment, but now maybe evolving into patients who, in some cases, may benefit from treating a second lobe. The other thing I don't want to fail to mention, and of course I'm focusing on the interventional, minimally invasive, non-surgical approach, we have multidisciplinary reviews of all these patients so that we have our surgeons who can perform surgical lung volume reduction. We have to consider lung transplantation. So to make sure that we really look comprehensively about the patient to say, well, what would be the most correct procedure in conjunction with shared decision-making with the patient? Certainly having the valves put in doesn't burn the bridge for surgical lung volume reduction or lung transplant. They can be removed if for any reason they're deemed no longer effective or the patient desires otherwise.
Very good. And then I would like you to speak a little bit more about rheoplasty and the targeted lung denervation, if you could.
Okay, perfect. So these are actually IRB-approved research trials, multi-center trials. I will distinguish two things. So the Airflow 3 trial is the targeted lung denervation trial. Specific to that, it's actually a thermal ablative therapy applied bronchoscopically to each airway, the right main airway and the left main airway. And it's really looking to denervate the parasympathetic chain that lines externally the lungs and is responsible for overreactivity, for example, in patients who may have more frequent exacerbations and or mucus production or combination. And the intention of the outcomes being measured for that particular intervention, it's a one-time treatment, is basically that it can reduce COPD exacerbations in patients who have known frequent exacerbation rate, reduce hospitalizations, severity, and need for prednisone. Those are the big three outcome measures to look at. And the patients who are more apt to be considered for this can have anywhere from mild to severe COPD, but they in the preceding year have to have had one, either one hospitalization for COPD or two distinct exacerbations as an outpatient requiring prednisone and cannot be actively smoking. The other study, the rheoplasty trial, RESOLVE trial, it's distinctly different. It's also a study geared towards COPD patients who have chronic bronchitis. They can have anywhere from severe to mild COPD or moderate COPD, but they have, by definition, 3 months of consecutive productive cough, 2 years in a row. That defines chronic bronchitis. So for the patient who has chronic bronchitis, rheoplasty is a non-thermal pulse energy applied to not only the larger airways, but the small airways, as it reduces mucus production and the glandular productivity and the degree of glands present in those areas of the respiratory epithelium. And by reducing those elements, it markedly reduces the symptoms that go along with chronic bronchitis. And we're actively enrolling here at Leahy as part of those multi-center trials.
So I don't want to leave out the population of interstitial lung disease where interventional pulmonologists are playing a role. Between the ever-advancing approaches to the radiographic differential diagnosis on CAT scans, the biopsy techniques of the interventional pulmonologist can often prevent the need for open biopsies when the question of diagnosis remains. I'm particularly interested in your thoughts on cryobiopsies and the role they may be playing.
Sure. So I open it up even a little further than that. I think you're right. We have evolved where we have pathways, depending on what the CT resolution of the CT, high-res CT scans are showing. Sometimes in the construct of the patient's history, serologic workup, environmental assessments, along with the CT scan, pathways can be carved out sometimes even without biopsy. Which has been a new evolution over the last several years. And then secondly, on the other end of the spectrum, the surgical biopsy. So we look at several things in terms of what's in between. Well, when we think about bronchoscopy, there's two modalities in which we may be able to achieve a diagnosis of an interstitial lung disease that can be actionable for therapy and prognostication, and also a ruling out process can happen with bronchoscopy as well. And what I mean by that, by doing a basic bronchoscopy with a lavage, doing cell markers, looking for infection, looking for other etiologies for ILD, interstitial lung disease, we can also perform transbronchial biopsies. Traditional transbronchial biopsies with a forceps can be obtained and used, and there's actually a test called Envisia. It's actually a test, it's a genomic classifier that they utilize the transbronchial biopsies, and they only need small amounts of tissue to do that. And between 3 to 5 biopsies, they can establish at least a pattern and a prediction of sensitivity and specificity for UIP, usual interstitial pneumonia or pneumonitis. Now, when we think about cryobiopsies, you're right. Cryobiopsies can be performed bronchoscopically, and they are. And the benefit of the cryobiopsy would be that there's a variety of probes that can be used that can allow us to get into the periphery, to attach to the parenchyma that has the representative disease tissue. And these allow for two things, sometimes larger biopsies, also less crush artifact from a traditional transbronchial forceps biopsy, and they allow for a better pathologic review. I think that there are pros and cons, and there are limitations to these, but they are now in the spectrum of what we can offer bronchoscopically, shy of a surgical lung biopsy. So we're moving more toward bronchoscopic evaluation and moving a little bit further away from surgical biopsies. Although I will say, with the evolution of robotic surgical biopsies, they are taking their own tact on minimally invasive approaches too. So we have lots of offerings for patients, lots of options to really render a more definitive diagnosis when it's needed like that.
Well, Dr. Lamb, you've really covered a lot, and our listeners should realize you've been involved in a lot of what the field of interventional pulmonology is and is becoming. Where do you see things going from here? Any particular things you see in the future?
Yes. I think several things. I think we're going to see evolution of these navigation and robotic platforms in ways that extend our reach further, but not just the reach to diagnosis, the reach to therapeutics, so that patients who either are not eligible for surgical intervention or don't desire surgical intervention, you know, pushing toward equal outcomes to surgical options would be really quite an accomplishment, I think, in the field. I think that early detection, pushing molecular testing, what we do with the samples we obtain, being able to use smaller samples more efficiently, less complication rates, better accuracy. I think those are all in every category that we are working in. I think we want to push those envelopes further and really get a sense of how to define which patients may benefit most from certain interventions, so maybe we can offer those interventions even earlier in their evaluation timeline. I also think it's very exciting to be a physician who's looking to train in new technology, but also not just define IP as a purely technology driven. We're driven by evidence and by thoughtfulness of how we apply things, how we train our physicians. I think the more we adopt technology, but let the training be foot lockstep with the technology, so that we're that sometimes we have often seen technology brought to bear before we have all the information. And I do believe that we're early adopters, but at the same time, I think it's a very exciting time for us to really push the envelope and how we train our physicians in a really responsible way, that this can be globally offered. There'll be standardized practice in how we train, how we assess knowledge. And thinking about it this way, I've been out of fellowship for maybe 20 years. So technology keeps rolling along far beyond our graduation from our fellowships. So I think that partnering with industry and science, where we get in the same room on a regular basis up front to have these conversations, because we can probably solve a lot of each other's questions and challenges by working together very early on. So I think, to me, the future only gets brighter. I feel very energized. Even as I approach, you know, later stages of my career, I feel like I'm still able to, I'm learning new things. And I think that's what makes it so vital and exciting, and seeing physicians of all ages and all different career paths, you know, learning technology together. But I think the fellowship programs and becoming now recognized in the way that we have been this week is really, really exciting. So you can tell I could probably go on for a long time.
Thank you so much for the energy and enthusiasm that you're bringing to the field, as well as your expertise and the insights you gave us today. So thank you again very much.
Thank you so much. It was really a privilege. Thank you.
Thanks again to Dr. Lamb for providing her influential expertise on everything interventional pulmonary medicine. Hers and her colleagues' work should be looked upon as an ideal model for developing subspecialties in our ever-changing fields of care. For more on subjects related to interventional pulmonology, check out our January episode on COPD with Dr. Gerard Kreiner, or our November 2021 episode on lung cancer screening with Dr. James Molsheim. For additional news and insights into respiratory health, be sure to visit us at hcplive.com and lung.org. Until next month, I'm Dr. Albert Rizzo, reminding you that if you can't breathe, nothing else matters. So just take it one breath at a time.